We have one final matter for the court this afternoon. The panel I introduced earlier, but I will do so again. To my left is Justice Brian Walker. To my right is Justice Mike Wallach. I am Wade Birdwell. And I will ask the clerk to call the case that we're about to hear, please.
The court will now call number 02-25143CR, Gregory Bell versus the State of Texas. May it please the court, until Robert Estrada will argue for appellate, Ms. Katie Bogman will argue for the state.
All right, counsel.
May it please the court. Again, Robert Estrada, Wichita Falls, for Gregory Bell. Before I begin, I'd like to make a couple of disclosures. The first one is I'm diabetic and my blood measuring machine is located in my phone. I put it on silence, but sometimes this thing acts up so my blood sugar drops.
Not a problem.
It currently, I checked it before I
started. You need to go get some crackers.
I'm in good shape.
Okay, just want to make sure.
But that's the first thing. The second thing, and this is embarrassing, I broke a couple of teeth here yesterday, or the day before, actually. But I can't see the dentist until Thursday. I hope I can enunciate, but I may slip occasionally.
Not a problem.
Your Honor, this case is haunting in the respect that Gregory Bell may be actually innocent, but I understand that that may be an issue for another day. We're confined to the record. We're confined to the way the court looks at all of the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, and we respect that and acknowledge it. The point that I made with respect to the insufficiency of the evidence really has more to do with whether or not you accept the earlier propositions. That is, that there was error in two ways, mainly in the fact that we were unable to cross-examine the technicians or experts who actually handled the evidence, as opposed to the ones that wrote the report. And secondly, that we feel that we were not permitted to fully defend the case because our cell phone expert was not allowed to complete all of his, what he could have told the jury. I want to concentrate most of my argument on the DNA issues and the confrontation clause, though. And in that regard, what I'd like to point out is that the record shows that there are basically four steps in the process. And I know they were described slightly differently by the testifying experts, but overall they were consistent in identifying several steps. The first one is when the technician just receives the item as it comes in, logs it into the system, makes a label, and then puts it in a safe place. Now, in doing so, that technician only handles the outside of the package. So there's no issues with us as to whether or not that sample could have been contaminated during the processing of the initial handling. Thereafter, another technician then further processes. Now we're getting to the stage where we have a lab analyst who then handles the item. Now it's that lab technician doing the wet work that separates out the items, puts them in a location so that the material can be processed where the handling takes place. That's the only person in the system who could contaminate the sample. The testifying expert doesn't actually handle the material. The testifying expert is reading a graph that's been previously generated and interpreting that graph to mean certain things. That testifying expert could not have contaminated anything because they're not actually touching any of the substance. They're not hands-on. It's the hands-on expert that becomes the critical one. Now,
so do you have any cases that say that the failure to bring the hands-on person constitutes denial of right to confrontation?
Well, I think I would rely on the fact that the hands-on person is the one who's critical to the subject matter.
Well, I understand your contention. My question is, do you have any cases that say that the failure of the state to bring that person to testify deprives your client of the Sixth Amendment right to confront the opposing witnesses?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm not sure that case has been raised from that perspective.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
Well, you know that basically the cases so far are making a distinction between, with regard to confrontation, with regard to those who are responsible for obtaining the raw data, okay, who don't implicate confrontation, and those who are responsible for analyzing the raw data, who that does, in fact, implicate confrontation. So you can't just take somebody else's analysis and give it to the jury through a third party. The individual who testifies has to, in fact, have done the analysis in and of themselves. But the courts, including us so far, are basically saying the raw data, that's something that doesn't implicate confrontation. I think that's what Justice Wallach is talking about with regard to case law. That's a distinction that's already there, so how are we to go past that distinction? Because the second step that you're describing is clearly a present, you know, obtaining the raw data for later analysis.
I believe I can rely on the general notion that we have a right to confront critical witnesses against us. And this person becomes critical. I think also the other dividing line has been whether or not that hands-on expert has written a report that's introduced in the evidence for the truth of the matter. But I think the report, that the paperwork, that the record shows that they actually generated paperwork that was reviewed by the testifying expert. To me, that's bringing in the report through the testifying expert because it's referring to it and acknowledged by them. We're still not in the position where we can cross-examine anybody that makes any difference. I understand the court's prior rulings and why they've been done that way, but I think that the courts are doing this on the basis that it's the testifying or the last person to analyze the graph is critical to the process.
Well, is there not a reasonable inference? You're talking about contamination and
yes,
being able to inquire about potential contamination, okay?
That's right.
But is there not a reasonable inference that contamination would manifest itself with regard to the presentation of the raw data?
Not necessarily. I can see that there may be some anomalies that are recognized by the testifying expert, and in fact, she did testify. The ones that testified, one of them in particular, did testify that she'd reviewed the reports and checked for anomalies. But when she further defined the term anomalies, she wanted to make sure that there was evidence that the material was separated. Again, she's not actually handling the material.
Let's go to the flashlight, okay?
All right. Yes, sir.
So where in the analysis with regard to identifying your client, okay, as having his DNA on the flashlight, okay, the raw data that was analyzed, where is the evidence manifest that would suggest that there was a contamination, that somebody had a piece of his clothing or something like that that could have contaminated the flashlight for purposes of the final analysis? In other words, contamination contaminated the raw data. So how do we determine that under the circumstances? Or are you just saying that the raw data should be considered to be a confrontation issue with regard to how his DNA got on it?
Well, let me address that last question first.
Okay.
No, I'm not saying that the raw data, I'm sorry, let's take it backwards. The raw data is created by a certain process that requires a hands-on by a technician. You're asking, where's the proof that there was actual contamination? Obviously, we were unable to develop that proof because of the failure of the state to call the expert who actually did the wet work in the lab. There's no way we could have obtained that evidence without being able to cross-examine that particular person. After that, what we're looking at is the final result, which is nothing more than reading a graph.
Well, I guess the problem I'm having with your argument is it looks to me like our opinion in Gourley versus State is pretty much on point with what we're looking at in this case, and it says there was no violation of the accused right to confrontation. That being the case, you know, we're bound by our own precedent, and I don't know that we can go beyond that.
I understand the court distinguished Smith versus Arizona. And I relied on Smith versus Arizona, and I still think it applies. I understand that the court may be bound by its own precedent, but I recall when I worked for Commissioner Green at the Court of Criminal Appeals, he described precedent as the hobgoblin of little minds. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to stick with precedent if it's not right. And I don't know that you've been asked to consider this matter before in the exact same way I'm talking about it now.
Because it's a confrontation issue is what you're saying, because you can't explore if there was any kind of contamination.
Right, well, unable to do it.
Because you don't have a witness to cross-examine.
That's correct.
And in Gourley, that wasn't specifically addressed in that case.
That's right.
And the court may have made that decision without even taking that argument into consideration, that facet.
That's exactly right.
I read some of the record in the case. I didn't read all of the record in the case. I can't remember. Did you actually make the argument to the jury that your client's DNA evidence on that flashlight could have been present because he had been in the apartment on previous occasions and had held the flashlight on previous occasion?
I don't recall if the argument was made, although the evidence showed that he had been in her presence before, and there was ample evidence of that. Not only that, there's no evidence whatsoever from the state as to when that DNA would have been deposited on that flashlight. It stands to reason if he'd hung around her before, took her to, went with her to casinos, albeit all in violation of the protective order, he was still nevertheless around her for a substantial period of time. And it stands to reason that either he could have touched the flashlight or that she could have touched him and then transferred the DNA to the flashlight.
So why is it not like a Kirby problem instead of a confrontation problem? Why is that not a reliability of expert testimony? Okay, because I understand what you're saying is basically, first off, was there anything in the record that indicated ownership of the flashlight? Was that her flashlight? Was there anything that testified, you know, that flashlight resided at her home, or anything else?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, what was the evidence with regard to that?
Well, some of it came from Gary Powers describing the flashlight being in her possession.
Before she was found.
Before she died. Okay. And I believe there was a video showing the use of the flashlight out of the vehicle. I think Gary Powers was actually in the vehicle, and she came out to the vehicle. I believe there was a flashlight that was used, and there's no evidence of any other flashlight. And the DNA, pardon my time's out, Your Honor.
You can finish. Joining.
Thank you. There was evidence of its, besides Gary Powers, there was evidence of that from an outside witness talking about what it looked like in the videos outside the residence earlier that evening of the flashlight being turned on.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
And she's the one that's stepping out there.
Okay.
To her car.
Good afternoon, Justices. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Katie Bogeman. I'm honored to be the 97th elected district attorney in our 97th district. I was assistant trial counsel in this case. My assistant prosecutor was the first chair. And I think that there's a couple of points. I'm gonna address the Crawford issue first, and then I'd like to address the issue in regards to the expert testimony in regards to Exhibit 6 and the defense expert, and then the sufficiency argument at the end. Your Honors, I believe that this court directly addressed this matter, as the justices had mentioned, in Gurley in 2025, and also cited to Downing another previous case from this second Court of Appeals in 2025 addressing the confrontation issue. In those cases, in the Gurley case, the DWI had blood results sent to an NMS labs, and the lab analyst wasn't available, but the expert that reviewed all the documents, he came and testified, and the lab report was not admitted into evidence. That's important in this analysis, I think. So also then in the Downing case is again the same kind of scenario where there was forensic lab analysts, there was the forensic scientist that testified, and then there was no lab report admitted. Okay, and when you're talking about the testimonial versus non-testimonial, the U.S. Supreme Court has addressed the fact that the raw data is not seen as testimonial in nature. And so that would be where these initial analysis that the appellant is arguing should have been available for cross-examination, that is where it's not really relevant here, because the raw data scientists in this case were the ones that only applied a certain measure. And I think our case even takes it a step further, because Faith Fornash, Amber Moss, and Destiny Morton, who are the DNA forensic scientists who testified in this case, all individually and directly handled the evidence. Okay, and so in the DNA section, Faith Fornash testified in great depth about how that process worked. And she's the one that actually cut the swabs for the samples to be then processed with the heat and the chemical, which is the analyst that the defense is arguing should have been available for cross-examination. And then she takes that raw data, reads all of that data, interprets that data. Then Destiny Morton does all her own sampling. The only person that ever handles those other packages that she handled in her analysis was the evidence tech, who labels that document to make sure that we have a chain of custody. They check it into the fridge, she picks it directly up, she takes it to her station, and she did that analysis, and then the interpretation, the conclusion, and made her report. In our case, we did not offer any of those lab exhibits for evidence to the jury. So I think those are very analogous to how this court had previously ruled in Gurley and Downing. And I think they're definitely distinguishable from the precedents in Melendez-Diaz and Birch, And then the Court of Criminal Appeals here in Texas in the Paredes case gave a really good discussion of the cross-examination or the confrontation clause in testimonial, non-testimonial, and then what that means in the end. And so they summarized that even though it may just be a supervisor who oversees the process, if they're only reviewing the raw data, not the testimonial data, and they're the ones that are doing that analysis and that further interpretation and drawing their own conclusions, that that is the proper witness to testify and be cross-examined about that evidence. In this case, those were the three that we sponsored for testimony. Those were the three that we allowed here for cross-examination. And I will point out that defense did not object in all of their testimony in regards to confrontation. He did at one point object to her being, Faith Fornash being a surrogate witness, but that was the only objection in that relevance, and then the rest of his objections went to more chain of custody argument rather than specifically the confrontation clause in Sixth Amendment.
Okay, so for clarity, let me make sure I understand it all right. So the witness that he wanted to be brought to court that was not in court was essentially someone that was handling the raw data, almost a person who's just really taking place in the chain of custody, but that person did not do any of the analysis on that data at all.
Yes, Justice Walker, you're exactly right. And in fact, it's very much like the Gurney case where the initial person takes the cuttings of the samples, and then this analyst is the one that submits those into the equipment. Then that raw data is given to that forensic scientist, and that forensic scientist then checks all the raw data. And in here, Faith Fornash specifically testified that she questioned her analyst about some things. She checked for any anomalies. There were no anomalies found in our case, much like in Gurney was also the testimony. And then she did the analysis, the independent conclusion, and the report. So she was that person that handled everything else in regards to that evidence.
And in some ways, it's almost like his objection is really about chain of custody more than it is about Crawford.
Right.
But, you know, and just chain of custody for any type of evidence, you know, many years ago, the courts were much more specific about the rigid requirements of getting witnesses in, almost every witness to testify, yeah, I touched this evidence. And then we've become much more lax over the years about that. And in some ways, we've become more lax about that in handling even DNA evidence. But his argument, obviously, is that by us being lax about that, we are not putting on witnesses who could be cross-examined about whether or not there was anything that could lead to cross-contamination. His position, at least he stated, I don't know if he was right, but that was not an issue in Gurley and we didn't consider that facet. What's your response to that? I honestly can't remember Gurley enough to know.
So, but it would be incorrect. You did consider that specific. It's a very analogous situation to our case. So in Gurney, you had the DWI, like I said, the NMS lab got the blood test. They provided that, the analysis. The clerk that was not there to testify was the one that put that blood into the machine. The forensic scientist is the one that interpreted that raw data. So all the numbers that spit out and all the graphs and things, that forensic scientist is the one that went through all that raw data, supervised the process, made the conclusions, signed the report, and testified. And then that report was not offered in evidence in that case. That's very much like our case here, where you have that analyst that's what they did. They did that one step to get that raw data, but they weren't the ones that actually analyzed, interpreted, and concluded or drew any information or testimonial facts about that evidence provided.
Let me throw a worst case scenario. Okay, I understand counsel's concerned about cross-contamination.
Yes.
Let's do a worst case scenario that Mr. Bell, all the DNA comes to this particular attack, got the flashlight. You also have the cheek swab.
Yes.
And the tech happens to just decide to take the cheek swab and wipe it all over the flashlight. Okay, that would be cross-contamination.
Absolutely.
That would be bad.
Yes.
Okay. But you're arguing that would not be testimonial. Okay, in terms of the raw data, that would be something that would be something for cross-examination on something else. It'd be more chain of custody, but also might actually be more along the lines of a Daubert issue, because there are other sources in the apartment where that DNA could have come to be on the flashlight. But how, so why doesn't that fit? You're basically arguing it doesn't fit into confrontation because it's not testimonial.
Well, specifically in this case, Judge, and I think in some of the cases that has been before this court before, when the expert testifies about their process and how they do that process, they do one item at a time to protect against that cross-contamination from one item to the next.
Well, I understand that. The question is if you had a rogue tech,
sure,
who did something like that, okay, we would probably find that you need to be a defendant needs to be able to find that out in some way, shape, or form.
Absolutely.
Okay? But the question is does it actually implicate the Confrontation Clause in my scenario that I've described, or is it just something that has to be done under Michael Morton or something of that nature, where those witnesses have to be made available for interviews and that type of thing?
Well, my answer to that's kind of threefold. So, yes, I think absolutely it would be a Michael Morton issue, and you would have to make those witnesses available and disclose that to the defense immediately upon finding that information out. Say at worst case scenario, if you didn't find it out until the testifying experts on the stand, that they didn't oversee that process, there was no check and balances, and there might be some indication that evidence samples were combined into the same area or same packaging, then I think you have an issue that would
towards
weight.
There's a thread of cotton.
Sure.
On the flashlight.
Right. Right. That would go an issue, I think, though, still towards weight, not towards the confrontation clause. I think the courts have been really specific from the U.S. Supreme Court and our Court of Appeals here in Fort Worth, as well as the Court of Criminal Appeals. And like I said, in Paredes, it really broke down, the Court of Criminal Appeals broke down lots of the kind of background for the U.S. Supreme Court, the Williams case that was a plurality decision, Melendez-Diaz, Birch, and Bull Cumming. They broke all those analyses down, and what they narrowed it down to is look, if you have this expert and they are participating in that process and they are the ones that are analyzing all of that data, you obviously, you know, when you're talking about your basic admissibility, you have to get in the foundation for that item, and that foundation evidence is where you talk about chain of custody, you know, how it's marked, how it's processed, where it's transferred.
It basically boils down to analysis is testimony, process is not.
Right. And I think in this case, we don't, you know, the one person who testified handled all the evidence and is the proper testifying witness. The one person who did not testify that the defense makes arguments about, well, actually, they in their brief, they cite three. One of them is just a tech that literally takes the package from law enforcement and puts the lab number on the outside of the package. They never handle any of the evidence. They don't open any of the packaging. They don't access any of the evidence in there. And so, I mean, I think you would have a hard time arguing that that person cross-contaminated anything in regards to the DNA. The analyst, I think that's most...
Well, but cross-contamination would be a process issue.
Sure.
Okay, and therefore non-testimonial.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that there are other means by which that evidence, the processing evidence, can be tested.
And I think the checks
or challenged.
The checks and balance to that system is your 702, right, where you have your expert qualification hearing. In that, you go through the certification of the labs. Are they abiding by their certifications? Are they meeting all the expectations by both the state and federal certifications for these type of analysis? And so if the defense had those concerns, then they address those concerns in a 702 hearing outside the presence of the jury. I don't think that becomes a Crawford issue or confrontation issue in this case.
That's a Daubert issue.
Yes. Yes, Judge. And then that would bring us to, you know, the issues on the expert testifying for defense in Exhibit 6 that was not admitted by the trial court in this case. The Court of Appeals reviews this in abusive discretion format, and so, you know, in that we give great deference to the judge who's overseeing the case, hearing the testimony, and weighing what is admissible versus not admissible. And the courts have said, the Court of Criminal Appeals has said, we don't intend, and the U.S. Supreme Court, for there to be a 13th juror, and so they don't want you to input what you think should have happened if you're doing it in such a form that you're only doing kind of a minute detail, this one thing, rather than looking at the whole circumstance.
Was Exhibit 6 a demonstrative exhibit, or was it substantive in like an affidavit, and his expert was not permitted to testify to his opinions that he had created with regard to that document?
It's a good question. The record's hard to understand what happened, but defense expert put together a whole PowerPoint presentation with multiple slides in the presentation. And the record will show that those multiple slides provided all of the basis information that he used to make Exhibit 6, which was the ultimate exhibit that was not permitted into evidence.
However, my question was, it appeared to me from reading the transcript that all the information which was in Exhibit 6 had already been talked about in front of the jury.
Absolutely. Justice Wallach, I think you hit the nail on the head. Exhibit 5 has all of the factors that they used to compile Exhibit 6. What made Exhibit 6 inadmissible is that it was an extremely misleading exhibit for the jury, okay? And I think what distinguishes this case at hand from the cases that the defense cites.
Well, but if it is extremely misleading, was that because it was the defense expert's opinion, which should it have been allowed in and then simply subject to cross-examination?
Well, it was allowed in through Exhibit 5 and the previous slides in his PowerPoint presentation and his testimony.
So everything on Exhibit 6 he was allowed to testify to in terms of his evaluation of Exhibit 5.
What Exhibit 6 did then, though, is take all this data that he'd already testified to and put it into a document. So picture this. He had arcs, and these arcs from these towers are where your cell phone's supposed to reach. Now, what distinguishes this case from what defense cites in his brief is this is RTT data, and this is a very important point in the case. RTT is different than active cell usage data. So where a lot of times the location has been admitted in evidence in previous courts' opinions, it's because it's active cell phone use data. So I'm actively sending you a text or sending you a call, and my phone is connecting to that tower. I have active. This is inactive data that the defense was relying on.
Tell me if I'm wrong, but prosecutors have used RTT data in their prosecution when it was inculpatory as opposed to exculpatory, and they do it pretty frequently. Would you agree with that?
Not just RTT data. So the distinguishing factor is the defense expert relied only on RTT data for his information in that chart in Exhibit 6. He did not rely on any other circumstance. There was no testimony or
corroboration. And I understand the distinction, but I'm saying prosecutors use just RTT data when that's all they have available to them, and it's used in court pretty rarely. You would agree with that?
No, I would say the active cell data, yes. So when you're actively making a call or text, that phone is being used, active data as it's currently being used, not historical data. So there's a distinction on the historical data. In this case, I cross-examined the expert testimony, and he acknowledged several things that make his exhibit very unreliable. One, that the RTT data is an estimate from the cell phone company. He has no idea in a rural area, he has no idea how these towers work or how the phones connect or which tower would maintain a phone in this area. Why is that important? Because we have such a small vicinity from defendant's household to the victim's home. It's 20 minutes away from each other. In this rural community, basically we have 3 to 4 towers that are reliable. And when he relies on this RTT data, he concedes in his testimony that the pings, so it's just the way the cell phone companies send out these signals to cell phones to make sure their towers are working. The pings failed on more than half of the times in his data, in his charts that were admitted to the jury. So he took, even though...
That means it didn't show that the phone was there.
There was a failure to connect at all to the phone in that area. And there's also another important distinction. Like I said, it's not active cell data that he's using. So he takes these arcs and these estimations that he doesn't know the distance of, that he conceded in his testimony in cross-examination, and compiles all these arcs together over a multi-hour period. So 2 hour plus period, right? From 11 to 3 a.m. is what he wants you to believe, that these arcs all show he's staying at this house. The problem with that is the RTT data is by thousands of seconds. So the pings are by thousands of seconds. It is more reliable when you're looking in a very short time span, when you're talking about minutes, when you're talking about maybe even an hour. But the defense expert conceded that when you're talking about a multi-hour time period, it becomes much less reliable to try to compile that data to say that this person is right here. In fact, both the state...
And that was in the record.
Yes.
But, you know, it seemed to be that, of course, the record was hard to understand, but that it wasn't that their point we're trying to make is where he was. They were trying to make the point where he was not.
Right. And so both the state and defense experts testified that they cannot say that he was at home the whole time or that he was at the victim Tia Hudson's house. They cannot locate him per the data they received in this case. They just aren't able to do it.
In fact, the jury was told that that the state could not place him at her house.
Yes, and the state expert
based
testified.
Based upon the cell phone.
Yes, and the defense expert testified
and
to
that. If there had been cell phone data that indicated that he was in fact there, I'm sure that would have been something that the state would have tried to get in to a certain degree the best that you possibly could.
Right, so you know, defense made an objection during the state's expert testimony in regards to some of the data he wanted to testify to, the very thing that he then says that he should have been able to get into, which is ironic, given the fact that he's now arguing that that was an issue that they should have been able to get into.
If you had only RTT data that could indicate, that increased the propensity or the likelihood that he in fact had been close to her home, you would have tried to use that, wouldn't you?
In cooperation, if we had something to corroborate it. So the problem here is we didn't have any surveillance video, any testimony, anything else that said that he was only at home, that he hadn't traveled. The exact opposite is true.
But their argument is that they had something to corroborate what they were trying to get in, and that was a video footage at a convenience store, I believe, in Nakona, showing a vehicle that looked like his driving by at a particular time.
I think that was a school, and that was after the RTT data time frame. So he drives by the school after 3 a.m. Their time frame that they were relying on for Exhibit 6 is from 11 p.m. on August 4th to 3 a.m. on August 5th. So that school video footage, the witness that we had provided to defense, she could not testify to the accuracy of the time format or whether or not it was correct or not. And so that video footage still was after the fact. In fact, we do even have an officer that he speaks to in Nakona, which is just minutes from the victim's house after just around 3 a.m.
Her house is in St. Joe, correct?
Her house is in St. Joe.
St. Joe and Nakona are about 20 minutes apart.
Actually, 15. They're a little bit closer, yes, but total from his house to her house is 20 minutes is what he testified, what the defendant told Ranger Engelman in his statements to the defense, to the ranger. He
okay,
also
okay,
indicated...
Counsel.
Oh, I apologize. I am out of town.
Not a problem. I gave you a little bit of time, and I'll give him a little additional time for his reply. So.
Yes, Your Honor. May I just briefly conclude?
Briefly conclude, okay. Please.
I believe that there's sufficient evidence, especially given the defendant's own statements in this case, to uphold the verdict and keep the jury's verdict intact. Appreciate your time, honors.
The clerk will give an additional minute to counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Let me address the fact that there was corroborating evidence that would have placed Mr. Bell somewhere else anyway. That evidence was also adduced by the videotape that showed him at a casino in Oklahoma for a good portion of the night. There was an eyewitness.
What time was that, actually, the video from the casino?
I don't instantly recall right now what time that was, Your Honor. I believe it was somewhere between 3 and 5 that morning, roughly. But earlier than that, there was an eyewitness that placed him at his place where he stayed right around the 12:45 to roughly 1:20 type period. The critical times for this case are between 1 o'clock and 3 o'clock. I believe 1 o'clock is the time that Gary Powers leaves her house.
And, right, and the officer sees him at the convenience store after 3 o'clock.
Yes, sir.
After this would have happen. My question, one question I have is, why would the jury not be able to reasonably infer the fact that he says, I'm coming over in the text, there's no dispute about that, and then he says something, there's a text with regard to going to the casino, and are you coming, anticipating that she would join him at the casino,
right.
But then he spends all of that time at the casino, and there's not a single text from him going, where are you?
Let me back up just a little bit. I don't believe that the actual text says, I'm coming over to your house. What he actually said, are you still at the house? I'm paraphrasing now, but here's the key but that I'm not paraphrasing. He says, if you're still at home, I'm going to stomp out. Well, that doesn't mean I'm coming over. That could also mean he's going to go ahead and go to the casino. He doesn't actually say I'm coming over.
But my question is that correct me if I'm wrong, but there is a text which would indicate that he's anticipating that she will join him at the casino. And then for that entire period of time he's at the casino, he appears to be indifferent as to whether or not she will join him or not. And why would a jury not be reasonable in inferring that he knew she wasn't going to be joining him?
Well, there's all kinds of things the jury could have inferred from that, and then probably that includes one of them.
Okay.
But it could be, they could also infer that he was just tired of the fact that she was not wanting anything to do with him.
Okay. With regard to the cell phone and the fact that Exhibit 6 does not come in, what's the harm analysis there? If, in fact, the state concedes in front of the jury that they don't have any cell phone data that places him at her home in St. Joe, how is Exhibit 6 exclusion, assuming it was error to not let it in, how was it harmful error?
Let me add to that. So you have the issue that Justice Burble just mentioned, but then you also have what Justice Wallach has kind of argued, or at least brought to your attention, and that is Exhibit 6 was somewhat cumulative of other things that the expert had already essentially gotten before the jury. So you have this cumulative nature of Exhibit 6, and then you also have the fact that you have the state essentially conceding to the jury or to a witness that they could not put him in St. Joe. So with that being said, how is that harmful, the fact that Exhibit 6 did not come in?
Well, I think, first of all, before I address the harm part of it, let me just make the observation that's already been made by the court. The fact of the matter is that the state could not place him through cell phone data at the scene of the crime. The other thing that we have to remember,
That was before the jury.
Right.
Absolutely. I mean, the jury, sure.
Absolutely. It was undisputed that they could not place him at the scene of the crime through cell phone data. And as I was about to say, the other thing that I think we all recognize is that the most any cell phone expert can do is place the phone.
Sure.
That doesn't, you know, the fact of the matter is that we infer that he was not placed in St. Joe, or that he was at or near his home, because that's where the phone either wasn't or was. And what we rely on is the well-recognized fact that by every court that's ever addressed this issue, that we are tied to our cell phones. I mean, they exist. Got one right here, right now, even in front of the court. You know, our cell phones have become practically an appendage to us, so we're correct to infer that if the phone's a place or a phone's not at a place, that the person who owns that phone is there with it.
Sure, and that goes to why trial courts typically admit this kind of evidence,
right.
And it, you know, it's because of that. Now, someone can always argue that if somebody's going to go kill somebody, they may be smart enough to leave their cell phone at their house, then go kill that person, that there's no cell phone pings showing that they were at the victim's home. But again, that's another thing that goes to weight. But all of that, that's true. But the question still is begged: how can the fact that Exhibit 6 not come in actually be harmful in this case when it's already cumulative, and you also have the state essentially conceding through a witness that they cannot place them there through cell phone data?
I'll get to that.
Yeah.
Your time's up, but you can answer the question.
Thank you very much. I think what Exhibit 6 is that it put it all together in a way that could be visible to a jury. What you've got is an RTT data is created when a tower is sending signals to a phone, and then the phone is sending signals back to the phone. And through that process, they're not doing it to keep track of people. They're doing it for their billing system. But at the same time, what happens is all you can say is a certain arc is created where the phone can be located anywhere around that arc. What Exhibit 6 did is it placed all the arcs to where they got him at or near a location, a vicinity. And to me, the harm was in not being able to bring the picture is worth a thousand words type evidence to the jury so they could see for themselves. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate counsel's arguments. They've been very good and very helpful. The matter will be submitted, and we will stand adjourned for the day. Thank you all very much.